Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we've got Paul. We're going through the amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And one of the things that I, you know, is really important, because we talked about this yesterday, that the Articles of Confederation were so inept that the Union was going to fail. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really came out of the haphazard process, because these were done in basically 1777, a year after the Declaration of Independence, while we were trying to prosecute a war and figure out what we needed to do. So, in other words, there was a level of urgency,
right,
in creating a government. And the real problem was that you had all these stake players, or I should say stakeholders, sending delegates that were very concerned about surrendering any unnecessary power.
Right.
And so they made, you know, they wanted to make sure that, well, you know, this is just a really limited government for a confederacy. So the right. way they laid it all out, you could almost, I'll just say this, that there was no reverence. There was no humility in trying to come together in a union. In other words, the Articles of Confederation for a perpetual union was just lipstick on a pig.
Okay.
Why would people want to go back to that?
So they had become, they had liberated themselves from England. And they were highly...
Not at this point. They were declaring independence.
No, they... Okay, right. They had declared independence, and they were highly sensitive to the tyranny that had been coming from England, and they didn't want to duplicate it. That's my guess.
Okay.
Right?
Right. But why not create a general government with the necessary power to do the job that you're asking it to do?
I think they had to go through the transition, GR. I think this is part of Providence, where they had to go through the transition that here's the first idea. Oh, my gosh, it failed miserably. Now what do we do? And you see from the document we read previously that they've got, like you said, like coming to a camp out and forgetting to bring the matches. Oh, we've got all of these things that we need to consider, which, by the way, sound really familiar because now they're in the Constitution, right? Uh-huh.
Right, yeah.
Okay, and so what happens is there's a transition taking place. Okay, they didn't jump from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution. They kind of failed along the way. And learned along the way, oh, this doesn't work.
Just so what you're talking about is an evolutionary process.
Right.
And so this goes to something we're going to end up talking about down the road. But when I started talking about this concept of auditing the Constitution and the details, because clearly I just challenge anybody to read the process of Republic Review. Republic Review is a pretty detailed process. I mean, if you have any confidence in your own work, then, you know, it is, I'll just say, a testament that you actually do that, that you put it out there for everybody to criticize. Mm-hmm. And here's the interesting thing. When I look at, you know, the process that evolved, because in my very first book, I really was just talking theoretically. And we've talked about this. but it was, you know, more theoretical of what we needed to do. I, at that point in time, hadn't read or hadn't become profoundly read on enough documentation of what James Madison, Jefferson was doing and so forth. I understood contracts. I understood contract law, that the states needed to hold the federal government to the compact, and that they needed to basically go through everything that they were doing and say, where's the Article 5 amendment for this? Where's the Article 5 amendment for this? And so that was kind of literally laid out in Section 4 of my first book. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because it evolved just like our government evolved. Mm-hmm. Things evolve. And if you looked at the authors of the Articles of Confederation, they probably weren't very proud after they realized what a defunct document that was.
Okay.
And right. I mean, so but when you look at the authors of the U.S. Constitution and those men who were proud enough, or I should say not proud enough, who had the confidence to sign that document. I am just shocked that George Mason was not one of those men. I mean, George Mason was a man of integrity. He was a good man.
Okay.
There's nothing that I've ever read that is negative about George Mason other than the fact that he was one that refused to sign the Constitution.
Okay. George Mason isn't he the one that's known as the father of the Bill of Rights?
Yes, because he was the one that created the Virginia Bill of Rights, but actually he's not the father of the Bill of Rights. Madison really was the father of the Bill of Rights. Madison was the father of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Huh.
He was one of the ardent demanders for a Bill of Rights, but the Bill of Rights was demanded by a group of people. And so he gets credit for what he did in Virginia for the Virginia Bill of Rights.
Okay.
He was the man that was integral in creating the Bill of Rights for Virginia, and Virginia was one of the only states that had a Bill of Rights.
Okay.
And so that's one of the things Madison was very well aware of. He was well aware because he was on the committee with Mason in Virginia.
Okay.
So he was, as a matter of fact, he was a young legislator at the time.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, we were heading into war when Madison, this young boy, what was he, maybe 19 years old when he graduated from Princeton. And if you look, that was right around the time we were in the throes of war as a nation. And Madison knew he had some disabilities, health problems that would not allow him to go fight for his nation, for this cause of mm-hmm. liberty. And he really wanted to be a contributor. And he prostrated himself to the Lord and said, you know, please bless me that I might be able to contribute some way.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, knowing and seeing and understanding all of that is just one of those things that really just, wow. I mean, it gives me a profound level of respect for the man, a profound
right.
level.
Yeah,
Because, I mean, look what the Lord blessed him with. Look at what sure. this man did. So, but anyway, back to Republic Review and the Articles of Confederation and our Constitution. This was an evolutionary process. And there's no doubt that, you know, when you stand up and say, you know, find the faults in this,
okay,
then you really do have a level of confidence. And my confidence does not come from my work at all in Republic mm-hmm. Review. My confidence comes from, you know, the understanding of what Madison and Jefferson were really trying to do and how they laid out this argument. And my understanding of contract law, I'm not a contract lawyer. I don't know contract law in and out like a lawyer would, but I understand contracts enough. And I think every American understands contracts.
Okay.
It either says this or it doesn't say this. I mean, that's what Scalia referred to the Constitution. It either says, it says what it says, and it doesn't say what it doesn't say.
Right.
I mean, it's just that fundamental. And what he was really saying, what he was alluding to, is it's a contract.
Right.
And so my point in looking at the Articles of Federation and why people wanted to go back to that, it was at such an early stage that it was defunct. And I think that anybody that has any romantic view of the Articles of Confederation really has no appreciation or understanding of just how, one, defunct they are and how great the Constitution became because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as we see how these men were struggling in operating a government that was so inept.
Right.
They said, we need to do this, we need to do this. They were actually, it's kind of like, you know, Lincoln being prepared to become a tyrant.
Hmm.
There's no doubt in my mind, Lincoln was prepared to become the tyrant to lead this nation through, you know, the purging of slavery.
Hmm.
But
even though that wasn't necessarily his original intention.
That wasn't his intention, but it clearly was God's.
Okay.
Even more importantly, when we look at what Lincoln did and how he was so tyrannical, it almost seemed divine that his service ended once the war had been completed.
Hmm.
Had he maintained his position, he probably would have been the first president to do 4 or 5 terms. He probably would have been the first president to actually cause such disdain in the South that we would never have been able to heal.
Wow. Okay.
Because, you know, he, if you listen to some of his tones, you know, he felt completely justified and righteously justified in finally winning the war.
Okay.
And he basically was saying, okay, now I have the reins of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that he was going to prove to be even worse of a tyrant after the war, of how he was going to basically supposedly, unite us and unify us. I think that this man was hardened in becoming a tyrant. And it was only because of the humility that he was dragged through after 2 years. One of the turning points, I think, was, you know, the fact that he had to write a letter to the same mother that lost all of her sons. And he realized that this was her last son that he had to write and thank her for, you know, his life and contribution to the Union and its cause.
Is this the... This isn't the mother whose son was going to be hanged for desertion, was it?
No. There was a mother who had, I believe, 5 sons that all fought for the Union.
Okay.
And this is the one that actually created the law that if you're the only surviving son of a name, mm-hmm. that, you know, you cannot be in combat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're the last surviving son of a family name, that they made a law because of this, because mm-hmm. this whole name was basically gone because
sure.
all of the young men in this family all died for the nation.
Sure.
And they said, you know what, maybe that should never happen again. And that's what they did. But that was one of those things that really humiliated, or I should say humbled, Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, one of the things I learned a long time ago is everybody hurts, you know, and
right.
it's not because REM wrote the song Everybody Hurts. This has been, you know, an absolutism. It's a maxim, right? Everybody feels pain. It is a part of life. It's just like, mm-hmm. you know, the human taste buds can taste sweet and bitter. Bitter exists, and the only reason we appreciate the sweetness is because of the bitter. And so, these contrasts are really important. But, you know, nobody is immune to these frailties, these conditions of life. And right. And Lincoln, you know, this was what kind of rattled him. But I honestly think that, you know, a lot of times you see people, they get rattled and then they get back up on their feet and they become even more tyrannical or what have you. And I saw that when I look at where we were probably going to go as a nation under Lincoln after the war, I do not believe that his interests were in healing the nation. It would have been really more to guard his legacy that he was right and what he did he had to do.
Okay.
Like dismissing Congress, basically telling Congress to get out of here and saying, because these other states seceded, they weren't there. So he said, well, then if we disband all of Congress, then it's like the states have actually created a rebellion. And it was Lincoln that was actually rebelling because he was denying those states that stayed in the Union their representation in government. He denied a representative government and actually created a dictatorship.
Okay.
Under what he called emergency powers. And there is no such thing as emergency powers. He assumed all of those things. And this is why Taney came up to him and says, you can't do these things. As the Supreme Court Chief Justice, he says, you can't do these things. And what did Lincoln say?
I think he said the Supreme Court can enforce it.
He said something. Let me see you enforce it. That's something like that. Yeah. Right. Let me see you enforce that.
Yeah, that sounds like something Jackson said, though.
Yeah, but that was actually Lincoln that said that.
Okay.
And so, anyway... now we are, you know, in this process, and we've got a couple more to go through. But I think that we've pretty much covered. There's just some final words, and I don't think we need to wrap those up. This really covers the fact of how they had assessed a certain value to each person. So I guess that there was kind of a perceived value of the property along with the person itself.
But the other thing, remember, there was something I wanted to say, and I lost track of what I was thinking. But the other thing is that the even the current federal government at the time was laying a tax on the states, and it was up to the states how to get that.
Yes.
Okay. So on the one state could do a head tax, the other state could do a property tax. It was up to the states how to figure out how to do that. And I think the original intent was that there would be a separation of the people from the federal government. You know, that's the idea. That's the heart of a republic. You know, that, you know, when they say all government is local. You know, and so I wanted to point that out. I lost track of my thinking earlier, but I wanted to make sure I brought that up.
Yeah, so that's why the direct tax within the Constitution was levied upon the state, and the state would then have to implement the process. But what they did by creating income tax didn't give the federal government the ability to, you know, create this army of taxation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's nowhere in there where they changed Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14, where Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. In other words, with the 17th Amendment, or 16th Amendment, my bad, with the 16th Amendment, they didn't change the execution of the law.
Right.
What they did, and this is how pernicious the 16th Amendment was, they created the IRS, which is unconstitutional.
That wasn't part of the amendment, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was only changing the direct tax from being to the state to going directly to income.
Mm-hmm.
And so how were they going to execute that? Well, they should have actually given the states the ability to, you know, make those assessments. But instead, the federal government pushed everybody out of the way and says, you're now working with us, and created this insidious army, a standing army to basically come in and verify whether you're counting or not. And so bottom line is what should have happened is the states should have, you know, created the execution part of that, of how to do that. And each state, so what you would have ended up having is there may have been a uniform law of application or for how to execute this new law or the 16th Amendment. But the actual execution may have actually been different between states, and we probably would have found a more efficient, a better way of incorporating an income tax at the state level instead of having the federal government do what they did. Because they never had the authority to actually execute that law. That execution of that law was to be done by the militia, period.
Right? And they still don't have that authority.
That is correct. That is correct. And but they just grew this army by 80,000.
Yes.
So going into the amendments that are out there, the next one is the amendment to share federal expenses according to population. And so I believe this one was April
1783. Okay, let me go there.
Okay. And so it's a short one. It's about three quarters of a page. But this is, you know, another problem that they had that they wanted to actually get into this. And actually, this one preceded the last one by a couple of months. But this one, you know, basically begged the need of the last one because, well, you'll see how they kind of broke it down. And the last one we just did actually laid out the taxation.
Okay, amendment to share expenses according to the population. Is that the one?
Yep, that's the one.
Okay, got it. Let me make it readable here.
Okay, yeah, that would be good. Readable is good. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So, here we go. Amendment to Share Expenses According to Population, April 18, 1783. That is a more convenient and certain rule of ascertaining the proportions to be supplied by the states respectively to the common treasury. The following alteration in the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union between the states be and the same is hereby agreed to in Congress, and the several states are advised to authorize their respective delegates to subscribe and ratify the same as part of the said instrument of union in the words following, to wit. So much of the eighth of the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union between the 13 states of America as is contained in the words following, to wit, quote, all charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States in Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of a common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value of all land within each state granted to or surveyed for any person, as such land and the buildings and improvements thereon shall be estimated according to such mode as the United States and Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint, is hereby revoked and made void. And in place thereof, it is declared and concluded, the same having been agreed to in a Congress of the United States, that all...
Okay, so with that, Paul, I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop right there, and I should have cut you off. We're going to go into a quick break, and so when we come back, we'll kind of pick that up where we left off. So, folks, we will be right back, and we're going to explain this, you know, this amendment of why they needed to do this, because it was all about the money. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we were just going through this, and what you actually read was a quotation out of the Articles of Confederation with the quote, close quote. And then after the close quote, they basically, and this is what you stated, is hereby revoked and made void, and in place thereof, it is declared and concluded, the same having been agreed to in a Congress of the United States, that all charges of war and other expenses that have been or shall be incurred for the common defense of general welfare and allowed by the United States and Congress assembled. And that's where you got cut off. Right there. So Okay. Go ahead and finish reading it.
Okay. Except so far as shall be otherwise provided for, shall be defrayed out of a common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age, sex, and education, including those bound to servitude for a term of years, and 3/5 of all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, except Indians not paying taxes in each state, which number shall be triennially taken and transmitted to the United States and Congress assembled in such mode as they shall direct and appoint. Quick question. What do they mean by whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants? Who are the others, if you have some idea?
So there may have been people who weren't necessarily white that were free. As a matter of fact, how many blacks were free in America at this time?
You know, I do not know in 1783. I do know that in my own family, there were three lines of... In my own family, I had three lines of free blacks pre-Civil War in the South, which I thought was unusual. So there must have been some. I just don't know the details.
Yeah, so there were. And there's actually, they have a consensus of this, but when the Constitution was ratified, there were only three states that denied free blacks the ability to vote.
Really?
Yes.
Whoa.
Only three states denied freemen that were blacks the ability to vote.
Okay, so I believe it couldn't have been North of South Carolina and Georgia, because I don't think you could be free and black in those three states.
So actually, Georgia was one of them. I believe it's actually in my document why counties matter most. I identify what those three states are. But here's the thing. After the ratification and after the first decade, states started going down the path of denying free blacks to vote.
So it didn't start out that way.
It didn't start out that way.
What, if you don't mind, if I can ask, what was the cause?
Yes. So it basically was the abolition movement. And giving free blacks the ability to speak up and say, this is just wrong, wasn't boding well for maintaining slavery. And so the powers that be, those people that were in government at that point in time, you were so anti-abolition, even though the most of the states were doing that, it's interesting that the Constitution and our government are completely disassociated. We have these things called voter blocks.
Okay.
In other words, we have interest groups that want to vote for what benefits them.
Okay.
But the Constitution doesn't allow benefits to anybody differently, right? In other words, liberty is liberty, and it doesn't know, gender, color, or demographics. It's liberty.
Okay.
And so as these, I'll just call them voter blocks, as they started establishing and as parties and these factions started growing, the Democrats in the 1820s wanted to make sure that blacks were not allowed to vote, because they were basically protecting their voter bloc. And so if you could actually, put liberty sideways, if you could just tip over the scale of liberty and say, we're not recognizing, liberty anymore, we're recognizing, almost creating a caste system to say, we have the privilege and you don't. And that's what ended up happening. And so it grew and grew. It's not that all states denied, but New York was one of those states that started denying blacks the right to vote. And so as it went through, there were still states that were allowing blacks to vote. And it went to the Dred Scott case. And this is when Taney basically said a black cannot be a U.S. citizen. Because if they could, then they'd be able to have guns and they'd be able to have, the rights to vote and all of these other things.
So this Taney, who said blacks cannot be U.S. citizens, is the same Taney that told Lincoln, you can't do this.
Yep. Very same. Yes. Yep. Ironic, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because they had agendas. And this is what I was trying to say. The Constitution doesn't allow agendas. They don't allow this crap. And these guys were bad players that were trying to protect an agenda. And this is what the parties do today. The parties started doing this, and they've perpetuated this. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we as a people still want to think. I mean, how many... Look at all of the different camps. If you look at a party as a tent, how many parties actually, recognize, women's issues? There's no women's issues under this Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
There's no black or brown or those issues are not relevant in our government.
Okay.
And yet the party clings to these. Why? Because it keeps us divided.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we are divided, we can be manipulated. But when we unify on the fundamental principles of the Constitution, then we can actually get some things done. This is why, I keep on pointing my finger out at all of these organizations that are actually stonewalling and doing everything they can to keep us from unifying.
Mm-hmm.
Those organizations that are so, I'll just say, grounded in maintaining, in keeping us from unifying or maintaining their myopic focus, they are the bigger problem.
Mm.
Whether it is the, the Women's Republicans or whether it's the John Birch Society, it doesn't matter. Whatever you're basically camping on this myopic, only us, it has to be thought here by us. In other words, we control the thought. I'm sorry. That doesn't play here in America. That doesn't play under this Constitution, and you are the problem.
Mm.
And the only way we're actually going to really heal as a nation, the way we should have healed, because, I mean, look at what ended up happening after we finally fixed and gave true suffrage representation and liberty to the blacks in America with, you know, this unconstitutional civil rights. We should have done that. We should have just done the right thing and gotten rid of all of these laws that allowed segregation and all of these things. Mm-hmm. But what did we end up doing? We basically did the same thing that I call out Mandela for doing the exact same thing, basically getting social justice. We started implementing social justice programs like affirmative action.
Right.
How does that heal anything? If it's wrong, it's wrong. Whether it was done wrong, you know, 100 years ago, oh, well, it's our turn to, you know, to relish in, you know, on the controlling side or the favored side or the privileged side. There should be no privileges. Mm-hmm. Other than the privileges and immunities that are supplied to all under that Constitution.
Right.
That's it. Why can't we just finally get grounded on the Constitution? And this is how we're constantly dividing ourselves in so many different ways, and people don't realize it. And every time I turn around, I see all of these little camps in every organization.
Okay.
Every one of them out there. And so one way or the other, we cling to these things because this is our comfort zone. You know, we find, you know, the common ground or the shared paradigm of, you know, us women, we have to stick together because we've been treated poorly. Yeah. Okay. Everybody actually has been treated poorly. Yeah, the term misogynist is not, you know, a single term, or I should say there is a counter term to that, and it's misandrist. But nobody knows the misandrist term. Why? Because misandry, right. To be a misandrist is somebody that actually looks at, you know, men as, you know, the same way a misogynist would look at a woman, right?
At women.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Huh. I've never heard the term before. I just learned a new word.
Yeah. And but it's like bitter and sweet. Right, we always have these opposing things, and you know there are these bad paradigms, misogyny and misandry. They're both bad,
right?
Right, but we're being told that we are a misogynist nation, but we're really not. We're really not. Actually, we have been a misandrist nation because we've been attacking men. We've been taking away a man's role in the household. We've basically have actually started attacking, I'll just say, the divine order, because I believe that there are divine roles of a family.
Right.
And they're not necessarily baked hard, but somebody needs to provide for that family. And that usually falls upon the men. But there are times and cases when the woman must do that, and that's okay. We have to be open to say it can't always be men. What happens if you've got a husband that comes back from a war that is a quadriplegic and he can't provide? Then it falls onto the woman. And we can't shun that woman because she's doing what, you know, the family needs.
Right.
We're so screwed up that we can't see through these things and actually just understand that somebody has to fulfill that role.
Yeah. What is that word you used again? Is it misandry?
Yes, misandrist. Yes, misandry.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. I just looked it up. It's never used. It is the antonym to misogyny, and I just never heard of it before. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, every once in a while I can pull a rabbit out of my hat, but anyway. Okay, so we kind of wrapped up. I believe we were just going into break. We're kind of wrapping up this, and go ahead.
I marked where I left off.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay,
go ahead and wrap it up.
So I'm gonna read part of that over again. as he is hereby revoked and made void, and in place thereof is declared and concluded, the same having been agreed to in the Congress of the United States, that all charges of war and all other expenses that have been or shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare, and allowed by the United States and Congress assembles, except so far as shall be otherwise provided for, shall be defrayed out of the common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to... Okay, I read that, the whole number of white persons, white and other free inhabitants. I actually finished this.
Yeah. Okay.
Finished this document.
I think, yeah, so we just squeaked it out. And
right.
Now what they're looking at, and they actually have this in here, that white and free persons and inhabitants every age and condition, including those bound to servitude for a term of years. In other words, they were still bringing people to America that you could still actually make a claim on land. You know, you come in and you work as an indentured servant, and then you would be able to receive
a piece of land.
Yeah, a bounty of, 100 acres or what have you. America was still kind of growing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So the next amendment is the grant of temporary power to regulate commerce.
Got it.
Okay.
30 April 1784. Okay, here we go. This is a short one as well.
Okay.
All right. So, granted temporary power to regulate commerce, 30 April 1784. The trust reposed in Congress renders it their duty to be attentive to the conduct of foreign nations and to prevent or restrain as far may be all such proceedings as might prove injurious to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Just a moment. I'm just adjusting visual here.
Okay.
And few objects of greater importance can present themselves to their notice. The fortune of every citizen is interested in the success thereof, for it is the constant source of wealth and incentive to industry, and the value of our produce and our land must ever rise and fall in proportion to the prosperous or adverse state of trade.
Right.
Already has Great Britain adopted regulations destructive of our commerce with her West India islands.
Right.
There was reason to expect that measures so unequal and so little calculated to promote mercantile intercourse would not be persevered in by an enlightened nation. But these measures are growing into system. It would be the duty of Congress, as it is their wish, to meet the attempts of Great Britain with similar restrictions on her commerce. But their powers on this head are not explicit, and the propositions made by the legislatures of the several states render it necessary to take the general sense of the Union on this subject. Unless the United States and Congress assembled shall be vested with powers competent to the protection of commerce, they can never command reciprocal advantages in trade, and without these, our foreign commerce must decline and eventually be annihilated. Hence, it is necessary that the state should be explicit and fix on some effectual mode by which foreign commerce, not founded on principles of equality, may be restrained. Okay? I'll just go on. This is really clear, and it's language I can understand.
Right.
That the United States may be enabled to secure such terms, they have resolved that it be, and it hereby is recommended to the legislatures of the several states, to vest the United States and Congress assembled for the term of 15 years the power to prohibit any goods, wares, or merchandise from being imported into or exported from any of the states in vessels belonging to or navigated by the subjects of any power with whom these states shall not have formed treaties of commerce. Resolved that it be, and it thereby is recommended to the legislatures of the several states, to vest the United States and Congress assembled for the term of 15 years with the power of prohibiting the subjects of any foreign state, kingdom, or empire unless authorized by treaty from importing into the United States any goods, wares, or merchandise which are not the produce or manufacture of the dominions of the sovereign whose subjects they are.
Okay.
Provided that, okay. Keep
going.
Provided that to all acts of the United States and Congress assembled in pursuance of the above powers, the assent of 9 states shall be necessary. Now, that's interesting. They're not asking for this to be unanimous.
Correct. And remember, I pointed this out when we were going through the Articles of Confederation, that there is this little thing called 9, the power of 9.
Okay.
That the Articles of Confederation do allow certain things to be moved forward with the consent of 9 states. But to change the Articles of Confederation, it requires all.
And so that, so as I was reading this, until I got down to this last line, you know, here's what was going through my mind. Did they get anything done, or is there anything that Rhode Island agreed to? All right.
Obviously
this
not.
Left line clarified that. For
yeah,
me,
obviously
right?
not. They never got Rhode Island once to actually step up and allow anything to be done. They stonewalled every time. So it was one of the other failings and why it was necessary. And unfortunately, you know, those anti-conventionites actually point to, you know, how they changed the mode of ratification where it required everybody. I mean,
right.
As a matter of fact, anybody that says that what they did in having to change the mode of ratification by lessening the number, mm-hmm. I wish that they inflicted their own lives, their families and everything, to say everybody has to get along. You know, we all have a single vote and everybody has veto power to kill anything.
Right.
And watch how their family actually becomes completely crippled, because there'll always be a child or somebody that will constantly veto this or that because they will be disadvantaged.
I don't think it'll last a month.
Right, but you make a point, you know, that a democracy is something where, you know, two wolves and a sheep decide what they're going to have for dinner.
Yeah, I think I heard that Ben Franklin was supposed to have said that, but yes.
Okay,
that's the direction.
If that is true, that's a two-thirds majority.
Mm-hmm.
But if you break it down to 100, you had, you know, 51 wolves and 49 sheep, then
right.
You could really see how democracy is really bad. And in the concept of two thirds, that's actually pretty decent.
Okay.
Look at what state would be able to pass any of these amendments if they had a two thirds rule. I actually have it, and I've got it in a document, how every state amends their constitution.
Okay.
And they're all basically democracies. There are, I think, one or two that actually come across as, you know, kind of reasonable, but they're all problematic. All problematic because they're fundamentally a democracy. There's no real checks, you know, amongst the sovereigns. In other words, if it's all about the people, then the people will demand that you feed them and you wipe their backsides and, you know, you baby them and pamper them. If it's all about the government, then the government's going to be more concerned with production and growth and those types of things. And so you have to have a balance between them, which is why we have bicameral legislation. Mm-hmm. And bicameral legislative bodies to keep the people, to keep government in check, and government to keep the people in check.
Right.
As long as you create these, I'll just say, these checks and balances, it makes it harder and harder to do foolish things.
Mm-hmm.
You invoke a democracy, and you can get the lemmings to run off the cliff.
Okay.
And so what we're looking at here, and what I really wanted to point out, and what I was chomping at the bit on this, is please note There's nowhere in here where they're talking about regulating the commerce of the states.
Okay.
This is all regulating foreign commerce, which is why in the U.S. Constitution, the line of the regulating commerce is among foreign states, among the states, and foreign and trade with, you know, Indians and Indian tribes. Mm-hmm. In other words, when you read the Commerce Clause, there is no intent for the federal government to ever regulate commerce within the states.
Mm-hmm.
States are sovereign. These are national entities.
Right.
And the federal government is there to serve them, not to become their almighty, you know, ruler.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to help everybody really understand all of this. And you'll get this out of the amendment for, not the amendment, the petition in calling out the Department of Commerce. Because the Department of Commerce, and they say, oh, well, we can regulate anything and everything under, you know, under the Commerce Clause. No, you can't. You have right. no authority to regulate any of the commerce within a state or within two states or between states. Only to regulate, to ensure among the states that they're not actually pitting each other, you know, in economic warfare or creating disadvantages. They're there to make sure that everybody has equal opportunity to bring their products to the market. In other words, when California started creating these emission controls, saying you can't bring those cars into our state unless you meet our standards, they violated the Commerce Clause. Now, I'm not standing up and saying we want to have more polluting cars, but for a state to actually dictate what the products are that you're going to manufacture, that is mm-hmm. absolutely unheard of under this Constitution.
Sure.
What California should have done was California should have said, we're going to start manufacturing cars that actually and created a competition in actually manufacturing. Actually, they should have gone to General Motors and said, we want you to open up in Ford and Chrysler. Come here and manufacture cars with these emission standards.
Okay.
Why didn't they do that?
Right.
When we look at foreign, you know, foreign car industries, that's exactly what they did, because they basically came to America, Volkswagen and so forth, and they started manufacturing these products in America so that they could avoid having to, you know, pay the tariffs and everything else. I mean, they did the right thing by just coming here and saying, well, we're going to build in America.
So they did the right thing by coming here.
Uh-huh.
But with whom did – so – and that was okay with Congress, because Congress has the power to allow that, right?
Yes, but that's a perfect time and that's a perfect question to bring into the next show so that we can actually talk about the trades and trade agreements and so forth. And so with that – we will be back in dealing with that question. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.